You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
Good morning, listeners. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And you are joined today by myself, Jacob Andrewafa, and we have Mary Mikanich as our co-presenter. And we're also joined by Simon, who is a guest presenter, who will be doing an interview with Simon later in the program. I'd just like to extend a warm welcome to Simon. I'll pass it on to kind of Mary to do the acknowledgement.
Thanks, Jacob. So 3CR and Green Left recognise that this show is being broadcasted from the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung, the original, the rightful sovereign owners, the storytellers, the caretakers of the land. White Australia was established on the attempted genocide and dispossession of the first people of Australia, and we recognise that this attempted genocide is ongoing. As socialists, we pledge to actively support decolonisation. We stand with all the First Peoples in their struggle for justice and the right to their land.
Thanks for that, Mary. And I'll do give a bit of a rundown on what we have coming up on our program. And we have quite a packed program this week on 3CR. So we'll probably start off with a bit of a news discussion about the teacher strike that happened over the past week, which was actually a very significant protest, one of the first teacher strikes in years. And then we'll be speaking to Dr. Simone. How do you pronounce?
Simon Titon.
Simon Titon, who is a neuroscientist, and we have Simon on to kind of discuss the growing transphobic attacks from the far right. And Simon is part of an organisation that helps, people escape persecution, especially those. Oh, well, you tell me.
I'm sorry, I'm not actually associated with that organisation, but I've been aware of them.
And good. yeah. So you'll be telling us a bit about some of the work that has been kind of done there. Then we'll be speaking to Mark DiRosero, who is an organiser for Socialist Alliance Gadigal Sydney branch. And Mark's just recently actually came back from a trip to Cuba. So we're going to be having a bit of discussion with Mark about the impacts of the latest US blockade on Cuba.
And what a name, Marx, and he's been in Cuba.
Yeah. And then we'll be speaking to Michaela Pangris, who is an organiser, artist, activist and Socialist Alliance member. He'll be speaking to us about the results of the South Australian elections that just happened recently. So, yeah, we've got quite a big program. There'll be lots to kind of cover, but maybe I'll pass on to Mary to start off about the teachers' strike.
Well, it was really inspiring. The estimates range up to 35,000, maybe even a bit more. I spoke to one of the organisers who said that he had been standing at the front of the march, just watching as it passed, and he said it took 30 minutes for the march to pass him, like, from the start to the end. So, you know, that sounds pretty good. And they were all really feisty. But amongst the teachers, there were nurses that had gone out in solidarity. I think there were workers from other unions sprinkled throughout as well. And all the signs from the different schools So, yeah, it was really, really, really inspiring. What did you think, Jacob?
Well, yeah, I thought the teacher's strike was fantastic. I mean, the fact, and I think, you know, it's probably important to kind of say that I think we need to have more strikes like this by teachers. Because at the end of the day, you recently kind of published an article that, you know, Victoria has the lowest funded schools and the lowest kind of paid kind of teachers. There is going to be need for sustained industrial action to be able for teachers to be able to win the kind of conditions that they deserve. In fact, it's very kind of disgraceful that, you know, we're in a situation where education support workers do not even receive a paid lunch break. The fact that they're also asked to perform tasks such as yard duty, which is the responsibility of teachers. And, of course, we are in a situation where the state government is spending billions on the public-private North-East Link freeway. And, of course, this is in the context of a climate crisis that is happening. So I think, yeah, there's a lot has to be said about the fact that the state government is not willing to kind of entertain a deal or take the concerns of teachers seriously.
Well, just a couple of things on that. First of all, the example of education support staff taking yard duty, that's not because teachers are shirking their responsibility. That's because there are not enough teachers to adequately staff yard duty. And yard duty, of course, is important because all sorts of things can go wrong in the yard if there's no adults, no teachers out there supervising. So ES staff have been called on to do this when it's not really their responsibility at all, not part of their pay grade, as people say. And the second thing is Carroll's response, the education minister, immediately after the strike was that he regretted that they went on strike, but he wasn't changing the position or the government wasn't changing their offer, which it doesn't address teachers' working conditions at all. And this, I think, is really central. This is why teachers are leaving, on average, around 3 to 5 years after they've started teaching. Young teachers, this is, of course. And that's why we have this shortage. Because, you know, people work for 3 years, maybe five if they stick it out till then, and they think, this is killing me. I'm not going to put up with this. But this is happening across the board. When we talk about the ABC strike, you'll see that the ABC workers are saying exactly the same thing, that their conditions mean that they're overworked.
Yeah. Hey, Simon, do you have anything you want to add to this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's happening in the US as well, unfortunately. There's kind of a similar trend of young teachers being burnt out. I mean, if there's not sufficient support, then like, how can someone be expected to live their life whilst actually doing their job? It's obviously super sad to see, and it really, I mean, in terms of looking into the future, it's very concerning because, education is such a bedrock of a, like, functional society, honestly, so how that goes forward will be hopefully better news, but will requires a lot of work to push back against it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So did you want to talk about the ABC strike?
Yeah, Jacob? Well, why don't we talk a bit about, before we go, because I thought we might play a song after this. And but actually talking about the ABC strike, in fact, just a funny story. I usually have this sort of routine of when I get home, I sort of just put on ABC News. When I put on ABC News, I noticed there was something interesting happening. There was no ABC News, and instead of the ABC News playing, it was BBC News being broadcasted. Yeah. And that's when I just remembered, oh yeah, there's actually a strike kind of happening. So the ABC staff went on strike for 24 hours from March 25th, and one of the reasons that they are on strike is very much in a bid to kind of secure sustainable jobs, fair pay, and improved working conditions. And probably the other reason as well is they also want to protect quality news and programming. Now, it is being reported by the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance that close to 1,000 staff participated in the ballot, with more than 90% voting in favour of industrial action, as well as unlimited stoppages of work, with exemptions in place to ensure emergency broadcasting continues. MEAA Chief Executive Aaron Madley said the decision to strike came after months trying to negotiate a new enterprise bar agreement. ABC staff are taking this step because they want fair pay that keeps up with the cost of living, genuine job security and working conditions that allow them to continue serving the Australian public with integrity. The decision to strike came after ABC staff voted no to management's revised enterprise agreement offer, which included limited improvements to job security, but no pay rise or changes to key conditions compared with the previous offer. Now, a few things that's got to note is the ABC management actually offered a one-off $1,000 payment that would not be added to base salaries, would not attract superannuation, and would exclude casual staff. The MEAA said that a below inflation offer of 3.5% in the first year and 3.25% on the subsequent 2 years threatened the future of public interest journalism. The union has initially asked for a pay rise of 5.5%.
I think it's also interesting to note that this is a really important point, that Michael Slezak, who is a journalist and he's the co-chair of the MEAA, the union, he said that people who are on contracts or fixed term casual employees, how can you report on things without fear or favour when you're not sure that if you say the wrong thing that your contract may not be renewed? So the management uses this as a way of making sure that the line that the government through the ABC wants put forward is done and not anything else. And they also, again, they say that they're being asked to do more with less. So similar thing across the workforce, I think, that's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And probably another thing as well to note is, you know, the cost of living crisis is going to get worse, especially in the context of the war on Iran. You know, we're seeing the massive price increases of gas, which is actually going to have an indiscriminate effect on the economy. Like, you know, the fact once you increase the price of fuel, it will start to seep into all sorts of things, because the whole economy in terms of, you know, everything that we do, like, you know, what brings the food on the table, you know, consumer products and essential products and everything does rely on transport to a degree, and the massive increase in fuel prices is going to really hit working people in lots of indirect ways.
Well, the latest industry to reach out and ask for support is the aged care industry, because their costs are going up as well. So, you know, this is centres that are supposed to be taking care of our most vulnerable, and they're experiencing difficulties as well now because of this situation. So exactly what you just said, Jacob.
So I think that we should play, I think, a song for the program to take a bit of break from the news reports. But yeah, all the solidarity to the ABC staff who are going on strike, but also all the solidarity to the teachers who are currently in the midst of a fight for better working conditions and better pay. So yeah, Green Left Radio would like to extend solidarity. Now, we would play a song. So I was going to play I'm This by Peter Cat Recording Co. Peter Cat Recording Co. is an alternative band based in Mumbai, India. Hope listeners enjoy. This is I'm This by Peter Cat Recording Co.
Baby, I just want to be free. Sometimes I don't want to believe. But oh, but I'll do anything for you. Baby, I just want you to see. Sometimes I don't want to be a part of you. But oh, catches on. I worship the wind and turn it into song. And who I am is not measured by what I become. But I know when I won't make the same mistakes. 'Cause I don't know what it is, I don't care what it is, I'm this. Baby, I think we should be.
You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and we were just listening to I'm This by Peter Cat Recording Co. Now, we are going to go into our first interview for the program in the studio, and we are very happy to be joined by Dr. Simone Titone. Yeah. Okay, sorry about that. I've just struggled a bit with some pronunciation. bear with me. And Simon is a neuroscientist who grew up in New York and California, but has mostly been living and studying abroad since 2017. They're currently a master's student at Monash University. Simon is also non-binary and uses they/them pronouns. Now, we have Simon on to have a bit of kind of discussion, you know, being from the United States. Simon has obviously been following and obviously has lived experience of the whole issue of, you know, transfer homophobia and queerphobia in the United States. And of course, the United States has been at the center of introducing a lot of quite awful anti-transgender legislation. And in fact, just something to kind of note as well, and a topic for a future program, but India is also introducing some really draconian anti-transgender legislation. And it's, in fact, I think the bill has actually just passed recently. So, Simon, maybe to kind of start off, I guess, the discussion, can you tell us about some of the latest anti-transgender bills that have been introduced across the US? What are some of the threats that Donald Trump has made, and what is the impact that this has had on marginalized communities?
Yeah, so in terms of the way that I see it, the anti-trans legislation being brought into effect has very real-world impacts and harms our community greatly, but I mainly consider it to be kind of a progress bar for the overall goal of the ultra-right-wing government, which is, in effect, to bring about a white Christian national fascist state. So, like, the anti-trans legislation is kind of like a symptom of that main disease. So I try to keep an eye on the government's progress in their mission, but from an international lens, I think it is important to remember that the framework that the current U.S. government is operating under, their eventual goal, does involve like completely erasing the lives of trans and queer people, along with other marginalized groups such as disabled people, black and indigenous people, people of color, and in the end, anyone that they can scapegoat to continue their grasp onto control. So it's, yeah, I mean, these things affect people in really drastic and horrible ways, but it's kind of a fever when you're really quite sick with something else. So in terms of like the actual legislation themselves, on the anti-trans bill tracker webpage, there's 747 bills in 42 states right now. Most of those are attempted bills. They're not like actually in effect, and most of them won't actually be successful, but the huge number and scale of that is on purpose to be overwhelming, and many of them won't pass. Their goal is to induce feelings of hopelessness and despair.
I'll pass on to Mary to ask the next question.
Yeah, so has there been any resistance? Has the response of the pro-trans grassroots organizations to these attacks, what has it been, Simon?
Yeah, there is a lot of resistance. You said grassroots, and it really is kind of very local, non-televised. I mean, yeah, the revolution is indeed not being televised, but it's kind of on a very local scale, I think, at least in the type of resistance that is effective that I've seen, largely because there's just been like consecutive institutional failures, like one after another, basically, that have kind of led us to this point anyways. I think largely due to the kind of moderate, centrist Democratic, the DNC basically has kind of led to a lot of that kind of failure of institutional support for queer and trans people. But outside of California, I can't really speak to resistance that much, just because I don't have a lot of context there. But from within California, there's I do have friends and allies who are mobilizing and connecting, and there's consideration of eventual infrastructural failures that will affect basic survival elements like food and shelter, but also importantly communications. One friend of mine has been working to establish a mesh network of devices that can communicate with each other without relying on other network infrastructure. And I think that's a really useful and important thing, because it kind of, community, it's kind of described as like a post-apocalyptic community, networking, but it is important in the various stages of potential infrastructural failures that we're seeing. On the topic of Yeah, so in basically on other levels there have been mass protests on for quite a while. A lot of those are, I mean, mostly it's not aired on legacy media, certainly. There's no impetus for them to really share that with the world, I think, because it doesn't look great necessarily for the actual government in charge. But yeah, in terms of like resistance as a whole, I think there's a really good resource to look to for that. One of the kind of most visible scholars of like resistance history is Tad Stormer, who's recently written a book about the topic, but also makes I think pretty nicely digestible videos on TikTok and Instagram that kind of address both the history of resistance in the U.S. and kind of contextualizes that, which I think is for me very helpful, because it's incredibly overwhelming and frightening to resist fascism. It's just like on a day-to-day scale it's very, very scary, and it's like it's very easy to get overwhelmed, and I mean I've dealt with that like extensively on and off for the past 10 plus years, but it's important to remember that these fights have been fought before, and continue to be fought in many other countries, and things are certainly very different from 100 years ago, but a lot of the fascist rhetoric is basically the same, and kind of relies on the same nationalist and
supremacist
exclusionary like scapegoating tools that they use. So I'm hoping that looking to the past and seeing what's worked will be of effect in some way.
Well, I think just the next kind of question to kind of talk about is what can you tell us about some, because I guess one of the things that is now a bit part of the discussion about the US, because the discrimination against marginalized communities is so high, especially for the queer and trans community, there is this whole question around leaving the US, or even there's also this question of even seeking asylum in a country. Because, I mean, for the problems that that Australia does have, and there are plenty, I mean, Australia is relatively, you know, quite good for LGBT LGBT rights, especially in the urban kind of centres. Rural areas, obviously, less so. So obviously, there's sort of like almost like a basis for a lot of people in the US, you know, trying to actually come to countries like Australia to seek a better life. And I guess, what can you tell us about the work that even organisations like Help Me Leave US, which is an organisation that sort of focuses on this, have done, but also this kind of broader issue of seeking asylum as a trans person in the United States?
Yeah, it's challenging. I can say that for sure. But I mean, I've since 2016, I've kind of had this very overwhelming fear of like being in the US for a number of reasons. There's kind of a residual, or like not residual, but like baseline stress that is much higher there than any of the other countries that I've lived in. Partially because of the governmental policies, but also the gun violence is just absolutely insane. Basically, there's a lot of reasons to leave, particularly now with like more direct attacks on queer and trans people. This organization helped me leave. I encountered them on TikTok pretty early on when it was developing. It's kind of been spearheaded by this really impressive woman, Charlotte Richards, who is on TikTok, Charlotte en France, Charlotte with two T's and then E-N France. And then on Instagram, her handle is how to topple tyrants, which is great. And so it's kind of, I think, just started from seeing the issue and then like actually just doing something about it, which is incredible. I mean, now it's over 50 volunteers who are usually working full time and then doing this on top of that.
And it's basically just a collection of resources for people who are interested in leaving the country, and which is really super, super helpful because, I mean, one of the biggest hurdles is just not knowing what options there are out there. There's a lot, so many steps. The bureaucracy of moving to another country is absolutely insane. I mean, I lived in the UK for a year doing my first master's, and then in my PhD I was in Belgium for 4 years, so I have experience with kind of UK and European bureaucracy, and it is very challenging. I mean, also with Australian bureaucracy, which, yeah, they all have their pluses and minuses, but basically it takes a lot of background information to be able to kind of start that process, and this is an incredible organization, I think, that has they've assembled a lot of resources. There's a Discord server that has advice on options for immigration to over 35 countries, and Charlotte's just recently put out that she's struggling a bit. She's working full time and trying to do all of this work on top of that. So she's trying to get help supporting her project, so that she can devote more time to the to helping people. So please consider becoming a paid supporter of her Substack if that is an option for you. But yeah, also just looking at the information and kind of being aware of the resources out there, getting this publicized, I think, might be helpful as well. But yeah, it's an important cause, honestly. I mean, I think I have a lot of, I don't know, cognitive parallels to the, like, Nazi Germany and people being stuck there. And I mean, that's what I was thinking when I was prior to the 2024 election, just how it's very, very difficult to leave once the regime has already been established. So that's, I was already very cautious of that, I guess, and very keen to kind of plan ahead, because I know how challenging it is to leave. But yeah, asylum itself is it's the last worst case scenario, basically. There's a lot of really specific conditions. I looked into that for myself last year, when there were developing anti-trans legislation happening. And it's very tricky. It wasn't available in Australia, and it requires that a country kind of makes a visible stance against the country that's kind of making these harms against their people. So a lot of countries aren't willing to do that, which I'm not sure if Australia will be willing to do that, but yeah, it is.
While you were talking just then, I was just visualizing boats coming from America with refugees on them. Yeah, so maybe that's what's going to be hitting our shores. Anyhow, my question is related to Australia now. So Australian polls before our last year's federal election showed support for the trans community was as high as 81% who agreed that trans people deserve the same rights and protections as all other Australians. So can you comment on the growing transphobic attacks from the far right in Australia, who've obviously been emboldened by President Trump, who's trying to spread his anti-trans crusade across the planet?
Yeah, that's a fantastic number. I feel really privileged and grateful to now be in a country that has that perspective. And I honestly think visibility is such a huge part of that. When trans people are visibly humanized, it can create a massive shift in perspective. And on the other hand, when trans people are reduced to being an issue, as happens when the only time we're discussed is when talking about bathrooms and sports, this dehumanizes us and makes us easier to pass legislation that can make our lives much more difficult and dangerous. The spread of far-right politics has been happening globally for a while now, and I honestly see it as being similar to how it was in World War II. Economic conditions are creating worse living standards for people, and rather than actually addressing issues and making people's lives better, right-wing populists are scapegoating marginalized groups and fear-mongering, which is basically deflecting responsibility and allowing them to hoard wealth. Because trans people make a small percentage of the population, it's much easier to dehumanize us and as a group and scapegoat us. since people are less likely to personally know someone who's out as trans. And I think that makes the biggest difference, is really just having a connection and humanizing someone on that level.
Yeah, and we've got probably 5 minutes left for this interview, so I might just skip to one of the questions, which is, I guess, why is it important that we stand with the trans community? And also, I guess, what are your thoughts on the kind of links between between capitalism and oppression of the LGBT community?
Yeah, I mean, basically put, trans rights are human rights. We're people that deserve the same rights as anyone else. But if people need a more, not to be crass, but like self-centered reason, like consider the erosion of trans rights that's affecting cis people in all the time. While the UK is trying to tighten laws regarding bathroom usage, the slope becomes very slippery very quickly. So how do you enforce that someone uses the bathroom that they were associated at birth sex, their correct bathroom? By visual appraisal, there's many cis women who have more masculine features that would be called into question, and trans women who have no masculine features. And then the extreme, checking genitals would be insanely invasive and wouldn't make anyone safer. I would say anyone can get involved with trans rights activism as long as you're approaching the topic with respect and intention of being an ally and amplifying queer voices. And in terms of capitalism and its relation to the queer community, I think of capitalism as being an opportunistic feeder. It will basically consume anything for the sake of growth. So with rainbow capitalism, they're more than happy to extract wealth from queer people, but when it becomes socially unfavorable, as it is now in America, they abandon all support of queer people. And since the capitalist class will inevitably align itself with more right-wing leaders, as fascism starts to grow in power, the puppeteers of capitalism benefit from oppressing queer people through their alignment with power structures.
Would you like to make any last comments before we finish?
Yeah, I think that now is a time where creativity is needed more than ever. We tend to underestimate the power of creative storytelling in shaping the future directions of social groups. But I think at the moment where there's so many massive changes to our lives, like AI, like COVID, all of these things have massively changed the way that we think about ourselves and other people. And having stories about what the future could look like is so important, both as goalposts and warning signs. And to quote one of my favorite writers and thinkers, Ursula K. Le Guin, we live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable, but so did the divine right of kings. So imagining a future outside of that is the first step to getting there, I think. So,
well, thank you very much, Simon, for being on our program. I think this has been a very important and good discussion.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having
Thanks,
me.
Thanks, Simon.
You know, there's people, like you said, have been on casual for 7 years. Well, it's supposed to be casual employment. People want full-time jobs. They don't want to be sitting there casual, not knowing they're going to get any days, any leave or whatsoever. Especially, you look at all the casuals in our industry at the moment, they're sitting home. You know, people want full-time employment, and they should be entitled to That's full-time right. employment.
And look at all the people who were used and abused as casuals in the aged care sector, and all the problems that are facing people now, and all the deaths that are following.
In the meatworks, a lot of that's casuals, labour hire, you know, you've got blokes travelling around, you know. We want full-time positions, and, you know, and people want it. We want to be full-time employed. You want to have your Christmas holidays. You want to have time with your family. But when you're a casual, you get none of that.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And we were just interviewing Simon from neuroscientists from New York and California about the attacks on trans rights in the United States. Now I'll bring you to our next next interview for the program, and we are joined today by Mark Del Rosero, who is an organiser for the Socialist Alliance Gadigal/Sydney branch and originally from the Philippines. He was an overseas migrant worker for several years before migrating to Australia in 2016, and he's currently serving as a councillor in the Central Council of Public Service Association New South Wales Trade Union, and he's also a member of the Australian-Cuba Friendship Society Sydney branch. And Mark's just recently came back from a trip to Cuba as part of the Southern Cross Brigade last December. Good morning, Mark's.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. So to kind of start off, you travelled to Cuba with the 31st Southern Cross Brigade last December to January 2026. Can you tell us about what you saw on the ground there, and what was sort of your observations about the impacts of the blockade?
Yeah. So when we arrived there, I arrived December 19. So this was, the situation on the ground there is already dire. Just speaking for myself, I saw like three immediate problems on the streets. First, when I landed there, there's a power blackout. When you get out of the airport, there's almost no electricity except for some street lights and, you know, traffic signs, traffic lights. So the power outages, the power blackouts can last from a few hours to half a day. And that's the first problem. The second one is the situation with the rubbish collection. So I think with the lack of fuel, and when the U.S. started blocking or positioning their warships around Venezuela, I think this was in August last year, there was pressure to limit the oil supply, because Venezuela is the main oil supplier of Cuba at that time. So what the Cuban government was doing is they were consciously rationing or trying to, you know, limit the use through like scheduled blackouts. And so that's part of it. And because of those, you know, scheduled power interruptions, there weren't enough trucks, fuel for the trucks that do regular rubbish collections on the street, so they were just piling up on the street. When I was in my taxi going to the dorm that I rented before going to the main camp where all the international brigades stayed for weeks, you can see the car maneuvering around the piles of rubbish. And the third immediate problem I saw, this was even before we landed there, is the presence of mosquito-borne diseases, particularly chikungunya. It's spread by mosquitoes, also dengue fever. So we were advised to always have mosquito repellents with us. So, and there was also one international brigadista from Venezuela who was sent home because they exhibited symptoms of chikungunya. So, yeah. But the effects after that, I noticed like three distinct periods. So before we arrived, the situation was already like that. There's already the problem of rationing fuel, scheduled blackouts, problems with rubbish collection. And then because of also that, there's almost no public transportation available. So you regularly see Cubans along roads and highways, trying to get a ride from private cars, private buses, private vehicles. Some of them are even offering to pay in cash. But yeah, because there's almost no public transport, you can't get to where they are. And the second phase, it intensified after the bombing of Venezuela and the abduction of the president and the president's wife. So that really, you know, The people I spoke with, there's fear, anger, uncertainty around that. And then there are also 32 Cubans who were killed in that invasion by the U.S. So, yeah. that escalated the situation even further. But before that, I left the island on January 9th, so the immediate effects of that I didn't get to experience as much, because after the events of the bombing and abduction, I left after a week then. But through the news, I can sort of get a feel in asking the people I met there how the situation keeps getting worse. And it's reaching, you know, really critical stages now after February, when there's no fuel, no oil to power transportation, because every industry, not just Cuba, relies on, you know, some sort of fuel to power your factories, your hospitals, your schools. So a lot of government services are almost, you know, crippled or not running at all in Cuba right now.
Good morning, Marx. It's Mary here. How are you?
I'm good, Mary.
A lot of the Western media is focusing on supposed attacks on the Communist Party of Cuba by ordinary Cubans. But what did you experience? How have the Cuban people responded? Is there resistance to the U.S. and a defense of their revolution?
So around the time of the events in Venezuela on January 3, it was known the next day that the 32 Cubans were killed there. So January 5 and 6 were declared national days of mourning. I was with the Southern Cross Brigade, and we were touring the Matanzas province. That's near where the Bay of Pigs invasion happened. That's where we were, and all of the hospitals and the schools we passed by, the flags are in half mast. And we heard reports, it was also reported in international media that hundreds of thousands of Cubans showed up, you know, to, like, in solidarity rallies in Havana. And imagine that there's no public transportation. People just showed up on the street. So there's still this massive support. And even if people complain about the response of the government or lack of response or delay in delivering the services, they know who the real enemy is. They know all of the hardships are caused by the illegal U.S. blockade. And so the people continue to resist, not just in the form of, you know, not focusing on overthrowing the government. There are indeed some elements of that, but there are few and far between. The people, on the whole, majority of them, even if they have criticisms, and you're free to express your criticism in Cuba, unless you're, you know, openly expressing sedition.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, the people there won't support a U.S.-backed coup d'etat at all. So, yes, they have complaints, but the revolution, this is maybe just my personal bias, but it's different there when people, you know, there are still people alive in Cuba that know the life before the revolution and what came after. And Cuba's, I think, among the Caribbean, has the oldest population because of their excellent healthcare and services. So that knowledge is still imparted. If people go to university, there's a mandatory Marxism course they have to take. People are, you know, almost everyone's literate. They know how to read and write. So there's mandatory education until year 9. So, yeah, people are politically attuned. They still know what's happening. Although, yes, some may, you know, have left the island to seek better opportunities. But, yeah, I still can see that the revolution's still alive, although the people are reeling. But they have the experience of what happened in 1991 after collapse of the Soviet Union. So, yeah, we hope that those lessons that people have learned to live through they get something from that and apply it again to this, the new generation's challenge. It was called the special period back then. So this generation has this special period to contend with. And but it shouldn't be up to Cuba, you know. It's like, yes, because the Cubans are resilient. They've been fighting for decades. They've been overcoming, punching above their weight despite the crippling sanctions and blockade that they have to go through. They shouldn't have to endure this. You know, the rest of the world needs to step up. They always vote in the UN, you know, to abolish the U.S. illegal blockade, but it's just a symbolic vote. Now's the time for action.
Yeah, so thanks for that, Marx. And I guess I want to kind of hear from... I might skip over this third question. I might go to straight to the fourth question, which is, what can you tell us about the Southern Cross Brigade and how others can get involved? Do they regularly do yearly trips to Cuba?
Yes. So typically the Southern Cross Brigade organizes trips around December, January. But there are also some brigade missions like the May Day Brigade. I know there's one comrade from Gago, Sydney, who will be joining the brigade mission because it's just so difficult to book a flight because of the fuel situation. But yeah, there's that. But the marquee event is always like December, January. So if people want to get involved, get in touch with the local Australia-Cuba Friendship Society branch where you are. There's one present in most major cities in Australia. So, yeah, that's how you can get involved there.
So many of us know what Cuba has done to support national liberation movements around the world, sending doctors, nurses, all sorts of people to provide humanitarian aid around the world. Why do you think it is important now to show solidarity with Cuba and the Cuban people?
Yeah, because Cuba, throughout its history, especially after they had their revolution, they never wavered in their internationalism. There's always that solidarity, that willingness to help, even for little or no gain. So we know that the Cubans, when Fidel and Che were still alive, they sent, you know, support for Angola, the ANC in South Africa, Algeria, Mozambique, even Ethiopia. So they know the power of, you know, national liberation movements and trying to push that socialist internationalism. But even then, that's only, you know, trumped by their humanitarian aid around the world. So the most recent one during the COVID, it's really dangerous to send people without a vaccine, but the Cuban doctors, the Henry Brigade went to Italy and other countries in Europe who will accept them. And then when they left, the people were so grateful for providing that level of health care when they were being ravaged by the pandemic and thousands are dying. There's also literacy programs. Cuba's literacy program is, you wouldn't believe that they did it in 9 months. They achieved like over 90% literacy in less than 9 months. And so they sort of help others with their literacy programs as well. So they did this with Venezuela, partnership with Venezuela, and it resulted in the Yo Si Puedo or Yes I Can program, which also spread even to Australia and Aotearoa, New Zealand. So Aboriginal and Maori communities benefited from that program of literacy pioneered in Cuba. And that literacy program as well, the partnership between Cuba and Venezuela, because when they were teaching the people how to read, they found out that some people are having difficulties learning because of their eyesight problems. And so they started this program called Operación Milagro or Operation Miracle, Well, it was so successful. It's a program, healthcare program, to treat blindness and vision impairment issues in among the population of Venezuela. It was so successful that it was, you know, imported throughout the region, Latin America, the Caribbean, even some countries in Africa. It was so successful that the Bolivian soldier who executed Che Guevara, Mario Taran, under a false identity, he applied to get cataract surgery. And so imagine that, you know, that's a victory of socialism, that the person who, you know, a brutal example of executing one of the heroes of the revolution, they repay that with kindness and, you know, humanitarian aid. So Cuba, to its credit, it doesn't, you know, it always tries to foster international relations, friendly relations. And the reason we went there for the 41st Southern Cross Brigade, that was the 65th anniversary of the institution called Cuban Institution for Friendship with the Peoples. So that's like an international movement started during the time of Fidel Castro to build partnerships and relationships with countries around the world who are willing to, you know, have that friendly relations with Cuba, not just trade. It could be cultural, educational, scientific. Yeah. So that's all, you know, just some of the few things that Cuba has done for the world. And the world shouldn't forget that. They keep going in the UN. So it's time to pressure your governments diplomatically, economically, to do something to pressure the U.S. To break away from this U.S. system. You need to pressure your governments. You need to protest. You need to spread the word that Cuba is suffering and we must not let this continue.
Thanks, Marx, for that.
Thanks, Marx. I think we might just finish up this interview and end it kind of there, because I'm aware, Marx, that you have to get ready to go to work around 9 a.m. So, yeah, so I think, but I think this has been a very useful interview. I also just want to kind of plug that we've done an interview with a bit of an expert on Cuba, Helen Yafe, who we basically interviewed for Green Left Radio, for Green Left. And I think I'll definitely recommend listeners have a bit of a listen to that interview. We will potentially play it next Friday to actually further this kind of discussion that we're having on Cuba. Green Left Radio has always proudly kind of stood with Cuba, and we're very much have always celebrated the kind of gains of the Cuban revolution. So yeah, I'd like to thank Marx again for being on our program.
Yeah, thanks Jacob, thanks Mary, thanks for having me.
Bye.
Thank you.
Okay, we're just speaking to Marx de Rosero about his recent trip to Cuba. Now, I thought we'll play a quick announcement, and then I thought we'd actually play a bit of a song to go, and then we'll go into the Green Left Activist Calendar before going into our third and final interview of the program. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And I thought we'd take a bit of a breather before we go into the Green Left Activist Calendar to play a song. I sort of play one of my favourites. This is Wish I Was Skinny by the Boo Radleys. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
to blame. Wishing I was kissing a girl with lips smooth as pie. Wishing I was pretty. Wish that I could.
Okay, you're just listening to Wish I Was Skinny by the Boo Radleys. And now I'm going to go pass it on to Mary to start off the Green Left Activist Calendar.
Yes, thanks, Jacob. So just before I get on to the first item, there was a notice in our pigeonhole here at 3CR talking about the proposed garbage incinerator for Whittlesea. And there's a community campaign to help stop. It's going to be a huge incinerator if it was to go ahead. So people are asked to put in a submission to the parliamentary inquiry letting them know that we do not want these incinerators in our community. The deadline is April the 3rd, and you go to the website www.parliament.vic.gov.au/waste-to-energy-inquiry to submit to put in a submission. So you probably get more information too if you googled No Northern Incinerator Wallet Incorporated. Okay, so Friday, March the 27th, there is a radical book club, and that's today. And the discussion is around the Communist Manifesto, that old great manifesto. It starts at 7 p.m. at the Resistance Centre, which is level 5 on 407 Swanson Street in the city.
Okay, so just to make one quick announcement, it was previously announced that there'll be a hands-off Cuba and Venezuela protest at 12 p.m. at the State Library on Saturday, March the 28th. That has since been rescheduled to Wednesday, the 1st of April, not an April Fool's joke, at 5:30 p.m. at the State Library. So yeah, just to note that the Cuban and Venezuela protest is going to be on Wednesday, the 1st of April. Also happening on Saturday is going to be the Strands Day of Vengeance 2026, and that'll be happening at 4 p.m. at the State Library, Swanson Street in the city. There'll be a film screening of Fanon at the Cinema Nova, and there's also a Strands Day of Vengeance fundraiser at 7:30 p.m. at the Cafe Gummo, 711 High Street in Thornbury. So, yeah.
On Sunday, March the 29th, we have the Great Ride of Return starting at 11 a.m., Royal Parade and Park Street in Brunswick. Yep, that's all the information that we have on that one. Then there is a rally, End the US-Israel War on the Middle East, Palestine Land Day, starting at 12 noon at the State Library, Swanson Street in the city. And we also have on Sunday the Solidarity Walk, Stronger Together, Walk for Justice, Respect and Kindness, 1 p.m. from the Princess Bridge, St Kilda Road, in the city. And on the same day we've got a smoking ceremony from 2:30 p.m. Camp Sovereignty, which is in King's Domain, Linley, I never know how to say that. Anyway, King's Domain in Melbourne.
On Tuesday, March the 31st, there's going to be a public forum, What's Behind the US Israel War on Iran, and that'll be happening at 6:30 p.m. with a meal from 6 p.m. At the Resistance Centre, Level 5, 5407 Swanson Street in the city.
Saturday, the 4th of April, there's a fundraiser, Rap Against Racism, 5 p.m. Cafe Gummo, 711 High Street, Thornbury. It's also on Instagram.
On Thursday, April the 9th, there's going to be a public forum, Teaching Against Racism and Repression, that's organised by Teachers and Teachers for Palestine, and that's going to be happening at 11 a.m. And the venue is still to be announced, but you can look on the Green Left website for information on how to book for the event.
Wednesday, April the 15th, there is a vigil, commemorate the 51 Muslim...
No, there isn't. Yeah, no, that's, no, that was just a mistake, yeah.
Oh, okay. So I'll go on to Thursday, April the 16th. There is a forum, War or Public Housing, Resist the Push to Defund Essential Services, 6:30 p.m. at the Multicultural Hub, The Blue Room, 506 Elizabeth Street in the city. It's organised by the Save the Public Housing Group, and there is booking available.
On Sunday, April the 19th, there'll be a rally, End the US/Israel War in the Middle East, and they'll be on Palestine Prisoners Day, and they'll be at 12 noon at the State Library. Okay, so that's pretty much it for the Green Left Activist Calendar. If we've missed something, please email us at events@greenleft.org.au. The Green Left Activist Calendar is published each second Wednesday by Melbourne supporters of Green Left as a service to the left and progressive movements. I'm just going to go play a quick announcement and we'll get our last interview lined up for the program. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
Being a 3CR subscriber is vitally important to keeping us community-controlled, grassroots and on-air 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Every 3CR show is a progressive voice that enriches and informs our communities.
From gardening and music to current affairs and First Nations voices, we broadcast expert community knowledge, offering perspectives beyond the mainstream media.
Subscribe today to be part of community-owned and community-controlled media.
Show your solidarity. Subscribe.
Go to 3cr.org.au or call 9419 8377.
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress.
The towers on Racecourse Road, Flemington, have become Homes Victoria work sites.
And welcome back. You're listening to 3CR, the Green Left radio show this morning. 3CR 855 AM digital and online. And we are now going to be talking with Michaela Panagris, who is an organiser, artist, activist and Socialist Alliance member. And she's speaking to us from Garnoora. Perhaps Michaela can correct me. Land or the colonial name Adelaide. Good morning, Michaela.
Hi, good morning. So, yes, I'm Michaela and I'm on Kaurna Yatta, which is the traditional land of the Kaurna people and currently called Adelaide.
Can you give us an overview of the results of the 2026 South Australian elections and the political situation that framed the election, please?
Yeah, sure. So basically it's been a ALP win, which was predicted and expected. So South Australian Labor was re-elected with Peter Malinauskas re-elected as Premier. So they did well with 37.7% of the vote. They won 32 seats, despite a negative 2.4% swing against them. So the political situation in the state is one that is dominated by the South Australian Labor Party. It's also dominated by that party's pursuit of AUKUS in the state. It facilitates many contracts with international companies, weapons manufacturers like BAE Systems and other companies to work in the state. And it's been working closely with the federal government to ensure that the AUKUS submarines might be, they say they will be, but might is the correct word, might be built in Osborne, which is a suburb. Osborne is in Port Adelaide, which is a suburb in South Australia. But AUKUS is one big factor in the political situation in the state. The other is a massive housing crisis. There's about 7,000 people who are homeless in the state. So we need thousands more public homes built. The Australian Labor government has not tackled this appropriately, and it has not made any pledge to do so now that it's been elected. The other major thing in the state that's important for us to talk about today is the breakdown of the Liberal Party here. They have been riddled with some scandals. Their support base has fallen apart. Their membership has fallen apart, and some of their members have even defected to One Nation. And then that's the other big story from the election, is the rise of One Nation. So Anthony Green, the political analyst, has described this as a political earthquake. So One Nation actually gained 22.1% of the vote, and it actually means that it beat the Liberal Party and made a challenge to the two-party Liberal-Labor domination of electoral politics. So I hope that gives you a decent overview.
Yeah, so thanks, Michaela. So going into the kind of the next question, can you tell us a bit about, I guess, actually the socialist campaigns that actually happened in the South Australia election, including you were part of the campaign running Anne McMenham for the seat of Port Adelaide in the South Australian elections. What are some of the issues that Socialist Alliance campaigned on in this election? And also I want to kind of hear your comments on the South Australia socialist results, which I think was also quite a good response as well to socialist ideas.
Yeah, so Socialist Alliance, we ran Anne McMenamin as an independent in the seat of Port Adelaide, and our campaign was really focused on anti-AUKUS. So we had no to AUKUS on all of our campaign material, and we really try to explain how the money and the infrastructure that the state was going to be spending on AUKUS will be far better spent on basic things for the community, like housing, health, and education. And we also ran a set of anti-capitalist, eco-socialist, and anti-racist policies. We had policies for First Nations justice as well, such as negotiating treaties. We had a plan to build massive amounts of new public housing, free transportation, real climate action, real action on the algal bloom crisis and ecosystem protection, as well as pro-Palestinian policies such as protecting the right to protest. So that was basically our pitch as Social Alliance and McMenamin. And the idea was that we were trying to reach Port Adelaide residents who are concerned about, you know, the health and security risks associated with nuclear power submarines and nuclear waste, which will be, if AUKUS goes ahead, will be a reality in Osborne, which is in Port Adelaide. And I spoke to a number of people on the polling booth who were very concerned because the Osborne base is literally 200 metres away from their house. And there's a real risk of nuclear waste, the health risks, plus the general rejection by a number of people of the militarisation of South Australia. So, you know, the response to our campaign was quite good. You know, we had a modest vote cast. We got 1.6% of the vote, which was, you know, sounds small, but given that we're a very small party, we were competing within a field of 12 candidates. We have limited funds. I think it was a good result, and it showed that there are some really conscious voters out there who really appreciate our socialist policies and our anti-AUKUS statement. Now, as to your other question about the SA socialists, or the South Australian Socialists. So they actually did quite well too. Now, they ran two candidates as independents, and they ran in two suburbs, two electorates rather, Leila Clendon. They ran in Enfield, and Ahmed Azar, they ran in Croydon. I'll just talk about the Croydon seat. So this is actually Malinowski's seat. So Ahmed Azar from the SA Socialists actually pitched his campaign around a protest against Malinowski. Azar's a pro-Palestinian activist, and he spent quite a bit of time during his campaign highlighting Malinowski's anti-Palestinian actions, such as Malinowski's push to cancel Randa Abdel Fattah from speaking at Adelaide Writers Festival. And that campaign was quite successful by SA Socialists because they were able to reach a layer of people within Croydon who were fed up with Malinowski. So they received about 6.5% of the vote in Croydon. And in Enfield, where their other candidate ran, they polled at about 5.6%. And the other issues that SA Socialists were running on were focused around housing and rising cost of living.
Oh, okay. I'd like to know what your impression is of the rise in support for One Nation. It seems to me like a really dangerous rise in the support for the far right. And what can we do as socialists to counter the far right and their anti-democratic and racist ideologies?
Yes, so it is very concerning. And when we were on the polling booth, when I and other socialist rights members were handing out how to vote for our campaign, something that really struck us all was how many working class people coming into the booth, walking towards the One Nation candidate, shaking his hand, giving him a pat on the back.
Oh, these God. Kinds of things.
Yes, exactly. So there's real support that One Nation has built here within working class communities. Now, I think there's a number of reasons for this. I don't think that every person who voted for One Nation is necessarily a full-on racist.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people expressed to me on the polling booth that they are fed up with the major parties. A lot of people in the lower socioeconomic areas within South Australia really have not had any benefits or improvements in their living standards for the past 40 years due to neoliberal policies. And they're really wanting a change. They want things to get better. And unfortunately, One Nation and Pauline Hanson are tapping into this. They're pitching themselves as an alternative to the major parties. However, as we all know, Pauline Hanson has never voted for a pro-worker policy in her life. The One Nation's policies won't help working people. In fact, it will make their lives worse. So it is a dangerous rise in support for One Nation, and we need to be really vigilant about it. But I think, we can't be all moralistic about it either, and we can't just say, oh my God, all these racists are running around. I think we have to tackle the issues head on, which is that working class voters are disenfranchised. And the question for us as socialists is, how do we actually reach those people?
Mm.
How do we encourage those people not to buy into the racist scapegoating and the anti-immigration sentiment that One Nation is pushing? And how do we reach working class people and get them to understand what the real solutions are and get them to understand, the real enemy is, the capitalist state, it's neoliberalism, it's war. So these are the things, it's a big task for us as socialists. And one of the strategies I think we can do is really work hard to build working class struggle. So something that was noticeable when I was on the polling booth is that a lot of workers who are voting for One Nation were not unionised workers. So, we need to be able to strengthen our work within unions, encouraging workers to be part of workplace struggles. Things like that will actually empower workers and, make sure that they don't just go towards the One Nation easy fixes. So that's one thing we can do. Another thing is, really doing more work within working class communities in cities and in regional areas and really getting our information out there. So One Nation had a lot of social media outreach, they did actually quite a bit of outreach in regional areas as well. So we've got to think of more ways we can get our politics out to people, which we're doing with, things like this radio program today. So I hope that sort of covers that question.
All right. Well, just wanted to kind of finish up with any kind of final comments you'd like to make, Michaela.
Yes. So I mentioned earlier that we ran Anne McMenamin as an independent on a ballot paper. And the reason for that is because there's a lot of quite anti-democratic rules and regulations which mean that for smaller parties in Australia, it's hard to get registered as a party to enter into state elections. So the Socialist Alliance has federal registration, but we don't yet have registration in the South Australian state itself. So we're seeking that registration. So I just wanted to call out to any South Australian users that we are still seeking registration in South Australia. And if you'd like to help us with registration, you can go onto the Voices Alliance webpage and click on the Help South Australia Register, Help Voices Alliance Register in South Australia page, and then you can click on some links to help us.
And we need supporters in Victoria as well to join our registration campaign for Socialist Alliance.
Yeah, so yeah. You can look up our registration efforts on the Socialist Alliance website at socialistalliance.org.
Thanks, Michaela. That was really interesting and enlightening. A bit frightening about One Nation, but we have to look at reality really hard and work out how to deal with trends like this. So thank you for your time this morning.
Thanks, Mary, and thanks, Jacob, and thanks to the Green Left Radio team.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to have time to play the song you requested. We're pretty much at the end of the program. I'd like to thank all our listeners for tuning in this week. I'd like to thank all our guests for being on our program, especially Michaela, Marks and Simon. And yeah, stay tuned for Left After Breakfast. You're listening to Green Left Radio on Free CR 855 AM.
Bye.
Bye.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Morning Breakfast with Green Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
If you like our work, become a supporter from $5 per month at greenleft.org.au/support or free call 1800 634 206.
Arise, you workers from your slumbers. Arise, you prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of Khan. Away with all your superstitions, serve all masses,
arise!
We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. That's right, the commies are back, reds underneath your beds and that crack.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.